For Antiwar.com and Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas, I'm Scott Horton, and this is Antiwar Radio. Welcome to Antiwar Radio. I'm Scott Horton. Thanks for tuning in. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Streaming live worldwide on the internet, KAOS959.com. This is Antiwar Radio, and that's what we do. Anti the war. Something like that. One of the greatest reporters we could possibly hope to have as a regular guest on Antiwar Radio, the great Robert Dreyfuss will be joining us in just over 10 minutes from now to discuss the situation in Iraq. And I sure am grateful for Robert Dreyfuss, his reporting and his insights, his regular appearances on this show. I hope you guys have come to appreciate him as well. What the hell's wrong with this thing, man? Yeah, let's try that. All right, so yeah, hey, I'm Scott, and this is Chaos Radio in Austin, Texas. There's an article today on antiwar.com that we're running by Arash Norouzi. This is a very important article. This gentleman, not long ago, I think about 3 or 4 weeks ago, we ran an article by him that I believe he wrote originally back in January called The Rumor of the Century. And I know the century is young, but this is the rumor of the century so far. And that is that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, has threatened to wipe Israel off the map. You've all heard it 1,000 times. Even if you don't pay attention to politics, you know that this is the accusation. And when we ran that article, it got, 80,000 something page views just the first day that we ran it on antiwar.com. Heavily trafficked and heavily linked to. I'm really glad to see that. Well, he has a follow-up article on antiwar.com today. I tried to get hold of the guy. I wanted to see if I could get him on the air. But he's got a new one. It's called Caught Red-Handed. Media backtracks on Iran's quote-unquote threat. It's by Arash Norouzi. And here's the bottom line. the president of Iran never threatened to wipe Israel off the map. The quote was, the imam said, this regime occupying Jerusalem must vanish from the page of time. That was the quote. There was no we're gonna, there was no wipe, and there was no off, and there was no map anywhere in the quote. I think it was Juan Cole's words that I read you last week, where he said, there's no such idiom in Farsi as to wipe something off the map. There's no such thing as that. And the bad part about this, or, you know, for the Iranians, is it was the Iranians who originally sent out the bad translation. It was the official IRNA, I believe is what it's called, the official Iranian state news agency. They're the ones who first put out the bad quote. And everybody in the West has run with it ever since then, even though it's not an accurate quote. And anybody who can read Farsi or understand it when it's spoken out loud will tell you. He did not say anything about wiping Israel off the map. He particularly didn't say that he was going to or Iran meant to or anything like that. And yet this lie persists. And this is a great article, a really long article today, by Arash Nowruzi, taking on the British Broadcasting Company and Reuters News Service, among others, for their deliberate, continued distranslation of this speech given by the president of Iran. And, you know, he even cites them saying, you know, it's not like any Iranian spokesmen have backtracked from this or anything like that. But that's just an abject lie. There have been, and he cites them, there are, what, five or six different times, including Ahmadinejad himself when he came to New York and spoke to the Council on Foreign Relations and the rest of them. His spokesman, over and over again, they didn't backtrack, they denied that they ever said that they would wipe Israel off the map. And so anyway, the lie continues to persist to some degree, but as Arash Nowruzi points out in his article today on antiwar.com, the truth is beginning to win out against the lie a little bit in the media. But of course, we saw the House of Representatives, was it 2 weeks ago or was it early last week? Voted on this resolution, passed this resolution, saying that, calling on the United Nations court system, the, I don't know, the Hague Tribunal or the International Criminal Court or whatever, to try the president of Iran for incitement to genocide based on this misquote. And in fact, I think it's in this same article, he quotes a Republican congressman saying, the Iranians have openly declared that they are developing nuclear weapons in order to destroy Israel. Which is just a lie, and never even mind what Iran says. The International Atomic Energy Agency hasn't been able to find any indication at all, much less evidence. They haven't been able to find an indication that Iran has diverted any of their nuclear materials or capability to a military or other special purpose. There's no evidence at all that there is a nuclear weapons program in Iran. There certainly is not a declared one, since all of their statements are that they mean to develop nuclear technology only for peaceful purposes so they can sell their oil. And here's the House of Representatives, of course, inciting to genocide. The House of Representatives, I think it was, there were 11 abstentions or something, 420 something of them, I guess, something like that, voted for this thing in the House. Inciting to genocide, basically setting us up another one of these Iraq Liberation Act type things where the Israel lobby in Congress, through their representatives in Congress, Democrat as well as Republicans, you know, basically are pushing us toward a nuclear first strike against a country that has never attacked us based on a threat that was never made. In fact, the quote, what Ahmadinejad says was, the Imam, that is Khomeini, talking about the leader of the Iranian Revolution from 79, remember him, the center of all evil in the galaxy, remember that? Yeah. The Imam Khomeini said this regime occupying Jerusalem must vanish from the page of time. Well, they didn't condemn Khomeini for inciting to genocide when he said it the first time. Then he's paraphrased in 2006 or whatever, and now all of a sudden we have to have a war over this? Oh, no, it was 2005 when he supposedly said this. Anyway, it's just not true, guys. It's not. So, you know, we speak with Gareth Porter just about every Friday, it seems like, on the show over these past couple of months. And he has roundly and completely and thoroughly debunked claims that Iran is supplying all the bombs that are being used against our guys in Iraq. It just isn't so. I just read a lengthy article about what our guys are up against fighting against, trying to occupy this town because of all the bombs buried in the road. And it says right in the article, yeah, a lot of times this is just, dynamite in a refrigerator. They bury it 6 feet below the ground, and then they'll let five trucks drive over it, and the sixth one they blast, or I guess it's the 11th one they blast, or whatever, in the quote. Anyway, our guys are getting killed by landmines, by improvised landmines, basically, all over Iraq, particularly in Sunni areas. And, no, they're not coming from Iran. That's just a lie. We've debunked that. We've had Gordon Prather on the show to talk about Iran's nuclear program. I gave him, he said, well, gee, I don't know if we have time left in the interview for me to explain, Scott. And I said, well, here, I'll explain it, and you tell me if I'm wrong. And I told him exactly what I tell you guys every week, every day, pretty much, on this radio show. And that is that Iran can make uranium-235 at a purity of 3.6%, and that isn't good enough. And the ability to make it above 90% purity to make an atom bomb out of it is extremely difficult. That the equipment that they have is a bunch of old crap. That the IAEA has inspectors on the ground monitoring every bit of their nuclear program and have found no indication whatsoever of a nuclear weapons program. Gareth Porter also came on to debunk the lies that Iran is supplying the bombs that are killing our guys in Afghanistan, which more headlines with those repeating those lies are in the news today. In fact, on the front page of antiwar.com is an article where one of America's cape-wearing felt hat puppets in Afghanistan accuses the Iranians of baring their teeth. What does that mean? The Iranians are helping America fight the Taliban? No, just lies. That's what it means. Just lies. Oh, yeah, Iran's helping the Taliban. Well, that makes about as much sense as America backing both sides in Iraq. Oh, wait, we are. Well, I'm pretty sure that that's just American policy. I'm pretty sure the Iranians are not backing the Taliban. Well, here's what I'm pretty sure of. I'm pretty sure there's no evidence that they are. All the generals on the ground immediately contradict Dick Cheney. Every time, isn't that funny how his name is right there in the word contradict? Every time a member of the Cheney cabal leaks that Iran is responsible for all the violence in Afghanistan, American generals on the ground in Afghanistan say, yeah, well, that's not really true. These weapons are coming from drug dealers from the north, and they're coming from private arms dealers in Iran, and the Iranian government doesn't have anything to do with it. Give me a break. That's the American generals in Afghanistan. Every time a leak comes out from the Cheney cabal blaming Iran for the deaths of American soldiers in Afghanistan, the generals, the American generals in Afghanistan immediately contradict them. And that's, I guess when it comes down to a shouting match and fingers pointing between the civilians and the top leadership and the military, Seems like the military is more likely to be telling the truth, particularly when the civilians we're talking about are the employees of the vice president's office. Anyway, so yeah, I guess I should play some music and get Bob Dreyfus on the phone for you here. We can talk all about what the heck is going on in the world. This is Anti-War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. And introducing, welcoming back to the show, the great investigative reporter, Robert Dreyfus. He writes occasionally for Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, The Nation. He's the author of, I would have to say, for people interested in what's going on in the Middle East, the most important book of the new millennium in terms of the history of American policy in the Middle East, Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Robert Dreyfus, welcome back to the show, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you.
It's great to have you here. And, well, I was going to start with a joke, but I realize now it's not that funny. So I'll just start with this terrible headline. U.S. says Iran using Hezbollah fighters in Iraq. And this is the Associated Press running in the International Herald Tribune today. Baghdad, a U.S. general said Monday that Iran was using the Lebanese Shiite militia Hezbollah as a proxy to arm Shiite militants in Iraq, and that elite Iranian Quds forces helped militants carry out a January attack in Karbala that killed five Americans. The claims were an escalation in U.S. accusations that Iran was fueling violence in Iraq, which Tehran has denied. It was the first time the U.S. military said that Hezbollah had a direct role. So tell me, award-winning investigative reporter Robert Dreyfus, do you have any indication that this is true, that Hezbollah is now getting involved in the war in Iraq?
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's possible because pretty much everybody is involved in the war in Iraq now. We've created a sinkhole, and there's no power within 1,000 miles of Iraq that can avoid paying attention because all of their national security interests could go right down that sinkhole if Iraq falls apart. So not only the United States and the British and others, but Iran and Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Syria and Jordan and all the rest of the Arabs and other big powers, and everybody's got to start paying attention because we've created such a mess there. So, look, Hezbollah, I mean, they may be involved in, you know, you know, creating some mischief there. But the fact is that Iran and the United States are pretty much the only countries left that are supporting the current Iraqi government. Prime Minister Maliki has put together a Shiite regime in Baghdad, which is heavily pro-Iran, which has the full support of the Iranian government. This top Iranian official just gave an interview to Newsweek over the weekend in which he said that we're, you know, fully supporting Maliki and so on. So, you know, if the Iranians are meddling in Iraq, it's mostly to keep this current government in power, which is also what the Bush administration is trying to do. So I think it's, you know, it's highly misleading to blame Iran for the trouble in Iraq. In fact, almost all of the people who are fighting us are either Sunni insurgents who've been the backbone of the resistance for the last 4.5 years, but also to some degree kind of some scattered Shiite resistance groups, some of them which are tied to Sadr, some which may get a limited amount of support from Iran, just, you know, so Iran can play all sides. This is very complicated. I don't think blaming, if the U.S. military is trying to blame the mess in Iraq on Iran, then I would say that's pretty much ridiculous.
Yeah, they'd have to just take the blame themselves. And, you know, it's funny, you look back to the lead up to the war and you see that Ahmed Chalabi and his Iraqi National Congress, their headquarters was in Tehran. And there are at least some in the CIA and the DIA. Of course, everyone agrees that Chalabi works for himself first, but people in the DIA and the CIA say that he was actually, you know, helping lie us into war on behalf of Iran. And we can see that makes a lot of sense, I guess, that the Iranians would want to get the United States to help overthrow their old enemy, the Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athists, for them. But I don't understand why it is that the United States of America insists on backing the Iran factions over every other faction in Iraq. Is it simply because they're the only ones who need us and will ask us to stay?
No, I think that might be part of it, but I think it's more just pragmatic in the sense that, you know, we went into Iraq with a certain, well, obviously no real plan, but with a dream or a hope that we could put in power these little exile proxies that we had, and that completely fell apart. So we're now back on plan B or C or D, and since the Shia in Iraq make up about 60% of the population, I think that there's a lot of people in Washington who figure, well, so we're stuck with them because they're the ones who are running the country. So, you know, we've got to deal with their big players. And so if they happen to be pro-Iran, you know, we're stuck with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can't bring the Sunnis back. And, of course, the Kurds can't rule the country. So it's not like there's some grand design anymore operating. I think that the United States is just, you know, flailing about, reaching this way and that way, trying to find partners in Iraq, trying to fight whatever bad guys, you know, pop their heads up. You know, we shoot at them. And mostly just, I would imagine, keep the status quo until they can solve the dilemma here in Washington about whether to pull out or not, which, you know, is going to really become a serious debate starting in the fall.
Mm-hmm. Well, you, in your newest article for The Nation, Saving Iraq, you talk about how the Iran parties are losing whatever support they had, that they're really just backed by America and Iran now, and that the masses of Shia Arabs in Iraq support the Muqtada al-Sadr faction over them any day, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. And
so
I think
is this just a decision they made back in early 2004 sometime, and now they're stuck with it, and they don't want to change their mind, or...?
Well, it's not about, you know, I mean, the problem is that anybody in Iraq who has any political credibility among Iraqis starts with the premise that, you know, they want the United States to pull out of Iraq. And so it's hard for the United States to find allies in the country, since any of them that have any political credibility want us to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, you know, if you're the, you know, the U.S. military, I guess you figure, well, we can't support them. We can't, you know, align ourselves with people like Sadr and with the Sunni resistance and all this kind of stuff, because they, you know, they want us to get out of the country. So who's left? And who's left are these guys that we, you know, continually find ourselves in bed with? And I don't think there's a, you know, a, it's not necessarily, even from the standpoint of the Bush administration, the best solution. I'm sure that they would rather, you know, find some other friends. And as you know, the military recently has been arming and training some of the Sunni tribes and others to fight Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe they figure, well, you know, we can build up that side of the equation in Iraq. But, you know, it's like now they're being accused, and I think rightly so, of arming both sides in a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I guess there's some truth to that. That's pretty much exactly what we're doing when we go into these Sunni neighborhoods and we find tribal leaders and we, you know, start arming their militias, where we spent all this time building up what's now essentially a Shiite army in Iraq, and now we're building up a Sunni army. So, you know, does that increase or decrease the possibility that when we leave there'll be a civil war? I think it increases it.
Right, and it just goes to prove the argument of those of us who've been saying this whole time that the sooner we get out, the better. Those of us who were saying that in 2003 and saying that all through 2004 and 2005. Here we created the El Salvador option, they called it. Let's hire local Shiites to create death squads to go around killing the leaders of the Sunni insurgency. That'll stop them. And then all the Sunnis did was say, well, fine, I guess we have to ally ourselves with Al-Qaeda then. And joined up with Al-Qaeda, they start blowing up mosques and everything. The whole sectarian war gets worse and worse. And now we're going to try to undo this Salvador option by backing the local Sunni resistance that we supported the El Salvador option against in the first place?
Well, see, that's what I'm trying to say, that there's not some big master plan going on. I mean, this is just, you know, I don't know, they're tacking, it's like, you know, if you're on a car, the analogy I use, if you're riding in a car and you hit a patch of ice, and you start steering wildly, you know, this way and that way every time your wheels spin in a different direction. That's kind of what we're doing in Iraq. We're not operating according to some grand design of here's step one and then comes step two and then comes three, four, and five and everything will be good. It's more like, woo, we're driving like nuts, and you know,
yeah.
And so one day, you know, you have the ambassador in Iraq saying that the big problem is the Sunni resistance and we've got to knock them out first. And then the next thing they say is, no, the big problem is the Shiite death squads and militias. And then they oh, no, I meant that the big problem is the Sunnis and we're back fighting them again. And now we're arming them. I mean, if you look at the statements of these, you know, various officials over the last few months, you just see that pattern over and over again. They don't even know who the enemy is. It sure, I tell you who it isn't. It sure isn't this little ragtag thing called Al-Qaeda. I mean, that's where they're trying to now put all the emphasis, as if, you know, this group called Al-Qaeda is the, you know, the main enemy, when In fact, there are a very tiny percent of both the fighters in Iraq and the population as a whole. So I guess, that, you know, I continue to be amazed at the utter lack of anything that resembles a plan.
I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm talking with the great investigative reporter Robert Dreyfus, author of Devil's Game. And now, well, to that point, the generals have said over and over again that Al-Qaeda is simply the smallest part of the insurgency, that they give it, what, 2 or 3% or something out of a couple of few tens of thousands of Sunni insurgents. The tiniest proportion of them, according to the American generals on the ground, are Al-Qaeda. And yet, as you point out, we see, especially just in the last couple of few weeks, this propaganda push, I don't know what else to call it, to accuse everybody in Iraq who fights or resists the occupation of being Al-Qaeda. Chris Floyd wrote a great article called Smearing the Dead from, I think it was Bakuba or something, where American helicopters came in and blew up the local Shiite militiamen, just the local neighborhood security force, who were working with the Iraqi police in a joint operation with the Americans. The Iraqi police said, hey, the Americans are coming, and disappeared. Boom. And the local militia guys went, huh? And looked up, and here comes some Cobras and Apaches, and blew them all to hell. And then all the press releases all over the world say, oh yeah, well, they were Al-Qaeda fighters and our guys are heroes for saving the world from them.
Yeah, well, that's why I say I don't think, you know, there's no more coherent plan to this surge and what, you know, what they're trying to accomplish. And
Who's making this policy? Is this Stephen Hadley and George Bush and Dick Cheney sitting around hashing this out? Does anybody have, do they even think they have any idea what they're doing?
I think, you know, if you asked individually in the Bush administration, what should we be doing in Iraq? You might get different answers from all those people. The problem is the administration is so utterly divided. That, you know, what you see coming out of their decision-making process is, as always, a ridiculous compromise among people who want to approach everything in a different way. And so I think you're getting contradictory, strategies from all of the chief cooks in this mess, you know. And I don't think that's what you can't look at it and say, okay, well, here's the plan, because literally there is no plan.
Never did have one this whole time. All right, well, somebody has a plan though, right? And this is something you've been writing about since at least last December. In fact, you were the first interview on Anti-War Radio discussing your article Bush's Meeting with a Murderer about the plan, such as it is, basically being back the Iran factions against everybody else, and how back then there was arising this new kind of popular front within the Iraqi parliament to create a new nationalist government, to basically overthrow Maliki and create a new nationalist government that would insist on American departure. So can you fill us in on what's been going on these last few months in terms of that national front?
Well, the first thing you have to say is that there's the population of Iraq, the massive majority of at least the Arab part, the Shia and the Sunni Arabs, want the United States to leave. And to accomplish that end, there are at least five or six different political parties within the Iraqi framework, plus, you know, the armed fighters who are not necessarily part of the political process that also want the United States to leave. Now, the problem is for this force that wants the United States to leave Iraq, which is also, by the way, anti-Iran and anti-Al-Qaeda. So they've got, you know, these sort of nationalist Iraqis have three separate opponents: the United States, Al-Qaeda, and Iran. For them to coalesce into a ruling majority is going to take some real doing, because the United States is opposing it. We're putting all the pressure we can on all of these Iraqi politicians to hold the current government together, or perhaps to, you know, purge a few more people we don't like from the current government So we'd be left with just the two, Shia parties, Skiri and Dawa, and the two Kurdish parties as the core of something called the Iraqi government. But that government would have zero support outside of Baghdad.
Right. This is the one we've really been supporting all along, the Iran/Kurdish compromise.
Right. Now, on the other side, the nationalists that you mentioned before, those people include more and more Shia, and I think you have to put Muqtada al-Sadr in that camp, this kind of wild-eyed cleric who, whatever else he is, he's not a stooge of either Iran or the United States. There's also a party called the Virtue Party or Fadila Party.
Can I stop you right there on Sadr, and don't let me forget what we're talking about here, the overall umbrella view of the nationalist grouping. But all the propaganda is that Sadr is a tool of Iran. Tell me that's not so.
Well, that's not true at all. I mean, it's possible that some of Sadr's army, his militia, has been infiltrated by or taken over by Iran, but that's different than saying that he himself is somehow a stooge of Iran. In fact, he went after the American ambassador, Ryan Crocker, held a meeting, as you may remember, in Baghdad with the Iranian ambassador, looking to, come up with some kind of U.S.-Iranian accord on how to stabilize the Iraqi mess. Muqtada Sadr issued a statement after that meeting saying, the Iranians somehow forgot to demand that the United States leave Iraq, because from what the Iranian ambassador said, that didn't even figure into it.
No, that's not a very good way for him to talk about his bosses.
No, and I mean, that's because these are simply not his bosses. I mean, anybody who has any role in Iran, okay, has got to have in Iraq has got to have some respect for Iranian influence. It's not like you can just dismiss them. They're a huge power, and they're right next door. But that's not the same thing as saying that Muqtada Sadr is an Iranian stooge. It comes out that way sometimes in American propaganda because we have to, tar anybody who is not an American stooge, and certainly he isn't that. So, when this so-called surge first started, a lot of the talk was the main target of this surgification that was going to be going on was going to be Sadr and his forces.
Right.
But he was smart enough to stay out of the fight and to not challenge the United States militarily. And so... it's almost like we've been trying to pick a fight with him, provoke. He says, they're trying to provoke my people into, some outburst that then they could use to, justify a crackdown. Again, not because they're pro-Iranian, but because Sadr is a nationalist who's not playing the game of, let's see who can be most pro-American.
Mm-hmm.
I
just think that's so important because it's not just that it's a lie, but it's the exact opposite of the truth. You know what I mean? We're calling this guy a stooge of Iran and going after him because he's not a stooge of Iran, and we're doing all this in favor of Iran's stooges.
Well, you may remember that last December, the American troops in Iraq and the CIA apparently raided the headquarters of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. They have a huge compound in downtown Baghdad, and lo and behold, they managed to find in this compound several top officials of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard who were consorting and consulting on providing weapons and other kinds of support to the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which is the main religious Shiite party that's part of the government.
Right.
So, and there's a long pattern. I just wrote a big piece for the American Prospect last month about the Shia. This Supreme Council group was founded in Iran in 1982 by Ayatollah Khomeini and the Revolutionary Guard. And its entire existence for the next 20 years until the American invasion of Iraq was as an adjunct of Iran's intelligence and military. And all of its leaders were in Tehran. All of its troops and its brigades, the Badr Brigade, were maintained and armed and trained by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. So this party is intimately connected to Iran. So to turn around and say, yeah, we support them, and to invite the Hakim family to the White House when they are the main Iranian allies in Iraq, and then say, and we're going after Sadr because he's pro-Iranian, that just makes no sense.
Right. Okay, now, I'm sorry, because there's another tangent I could go off from there, but I'll try to get back to it. Tell me about this Fadila Party.
Well, Fadila Party is also a Sadrist party in that there's a cleric that is kind of their spiritual leader who is a follower of Muqtada Sadr's father and uncle, who are longtime respected, you know, fundamentalist, of course, clerics in the Shia community, but they're separate from Muqtada Sadr's force, so they have a separate party. I think they have 15 seats in the parliament, and Sadr's group has about 30 seats. So right there, you've got 45 members of the Iraqi parliament who are Shia, and probably another 10 who are independent Shia. So that's like 55 who are not really supportive anymore of the Maliki government. Fadila pulled out of the government a few months ago.
And now you say in your most recent article, Saving Iraq and the Nation, that these groups are making an alliance with Sunni Arabs, with Kurds, with Christians, Turkmen, whoever they can find to form this nationalist front.
That's right. They've been reaching out to two groups, really, especially. One is the Sunnis, who have another 55 seats in the parliament. So combined with the Shia, that makes 110. And then to the secular party of Iyad Alawi, who's an old former Ba'athist who had a lot of ties to British intelligence, and then the CIA, who's got, I think, about 25 seats in the parliament.
He was the interim prime minister for a year or so there.
He was, that's right. So that brings you up to around 135 seats. So you're getting close to a majority in the parliament, which would be 138. And so the question is, could these groups come to an agreement with a, you know, a handful of other parties and so forth to have a parliamentary vote of no confidence in the government? But they call it the National Salvation Government, and it's been almost a year since this idea first came up, and of course every time it starts to come to fruition, the American commander in Iraq or the American ambassador, you know, start to knock heads together and threaten people and say, you know, we're not allowing this to happen.
Right, and then we see the leaks in the media, too, that say Maliki's worried about a coup d'etat.
Yeah, well, and the odd thing is, you know, the whole point of the surge, if you remember, was to create political space in Baghdad for a national reconciliation. And at this point, this national reconciliation between the Sunnis and Shia is happening outside of the people we're supporting. The people who are blocking this reconciliation are the Shia parties that we're supporting, who won't make any deal over how to divide up Iraq's oil, who won't make any deal about reintegrating the former Ba'athists into the bureaucracy again, who won't make any deal about amending the Constitution, who keep blocking every effort to come up with a unified plan to rebuild the Iraqi military and intelligence service. So all of these things, the so-called 18 benchmarks that are, you know, put into law now in the United States, none of them are being met by the Maliki government. The future of Kirkuk and the battle over the Kurds, all these things need to be dealt with. They're immensely complicated. And Maliki and his friends are like sitting there, you know, squatting in the road, blocking any effort to reach a deal over these things. And we keep saying, oh, well, we're putting, you know, pressure on Maliki to do it. Maybe we are. But it's impossible for him to do it because he has no political support. He has no constituency.
Yeah. I think the most important lesson here for everyone is the, well, it's some kind of lesson about the American media. Bob, we don't hear this discussion anywhere in the American media. Well, you know that there's a ton of people just waiting to form a nationalist government to end the war, to work everything out if only we would get out of their way. Talk about a lie by omission. Here we're having this entire debate that you describe, but without the facts that you're bringing to the table today.
Well, I mean, once in a while it gets into the media, the small bits and pieces, but, you know, I don't think that most Americans, fortunately, unfortunately, whatever, are paying attention to the details of what's happening in Iraq. I think they get the paper and they see that, you know, that, like yesterday there were 5 more Americans killed. And right now, you know, they've become sick of the war. And they've expressed that through their votes and everything else. But our I blame the media less than the population, in that I think the media, as they usually do, is, you know, giving the public what they want. And unfortunately, the public is not interested enough in the details of Iraqi politics for it to become a focus of media attention. And it's an accomplishment, I would say, so far, that we've gotten the public to even, you know, grapple with the fact that this war has gotten out of control. If you remember, it wasn't too long ago that this war had, you know, quite a bit of public support, including at the beginning of the war in 2003, despite all the, you know, informed comments saying that it was going to be a disaster if we pursued it. The president had at that point still a great deal of public support, and now that public support has eroded. So I don't know. I have trouble saying that the media is the problem. I think the two big problems, the ones we need to focus on, are the fact that the Bush administration is still running the show, and badly, and that the American public hasn't shown the appetite for demanding, you know, the kind of news that they would get. They'd rather hear about Paris Hilton, and that's what they get from the media. It's not a conspiracy by the media to, you know, divert people's attention with Paris Hilton, but they look at their rating numbers and they say, yeah, this is what these people want. They want to see the stuff about Paris Hilton. And so, you know, even Paris Hilton says it's dumb.
Yeah. I saw that quote. She said, I think they should talk about the war in Iraq instead.
Yeah. Well, as if she knows where Iraq is. But you know, the media aren't crusaders who are, you know, out to grab Americans by the lapels and shake them until they respond. The media is a profit-oriented system, for the most part. that goes where the money is. And right now, the money is not on, you know, intricate reporting about Iraq. Now, that said, I mean, I'm not defending the media completely, because they ought to be, you know, raising all of these questions that I'm raising repeatedly with the president, with, you know, elected officials in Congress and so forth, and you know, hammering away. But again, if you know a lot of these reporters, they themselves don't understand the situation. The ignorance of Iraq is not only deep, but it's broad. And so it isn't just our elected officials who have trouble knowing the difference between a Sunni and a Shia in Iraq, or knowing whether Al-Qaeda is a Sunni or Shiite group and so forth. But even reporters, you know, the ones in Washington, they're clueless about the intricacies of Iraqi politics. They, you know, they're much more interested in what's Hillary saying about the war, what's Obama saying, you know, what is Congress going to do, are the Democrats going to cut off funding, and so it's all that kind of, you know, fairly simplistic looking at, you know, who's saying what among the politicians, and much less people willing to get down in the weeds and say, I want to tell you about, you know, what's happening in Iraq today, besides the fact that five Americans got blown up. You know, I want to know what's happening with Iraqi politicians, and what, you know, what's happening with Iraq's neighbors, and what, you know, what's that stuff starts to get really complicated, and unfortunately Americans just tune out.
Yeah, it oftentimes seems to me like the reporters get the job based on how ignorant they are. Like, you don't know anything about Iraq, do you? Okay, you got the job. Kind of like Doug Feith interviewing who was it that was some CIA guy or something, where Doug Feith said, "Do you speak Arabic?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm fluent in Arabic." And he said, "Ah, that's too bad. You don't get the job."
Yeah. Well,
I mean, I want to see you on Hardball, damn it. Why? I got Bob Dreyfus on the phone here. He's one of the best investigative reporters that I can find to explain what the hell's going on in Iraq. For years now, I've turned to this guy. All I have to do is say, "Bob, what the hell's going on here?" And he tells me what's going on here. What's so difficult that Chris Matthews and Tucker Carlson can't call up Bob Dreyfus and get him on the freaking show, man?
Well, I can't help you there. Sorry.
It is frustrating, though, because honestly, I don't think it really is all that complicated. You know, you just picture a map of Iraq in your head, and you put labels on a few different factions, and you understand, okay, Dawa and Skiri, that means they're the Iran factions. The Mahdi army, that's Sadr and his nationalist guys. We know who the Baathists are. We know who the Kurds are. We don't have to know the name of every individual in Iraq to understand, you know, what's going on here.
Right.
I think
right.
You can get the point across to me and my audience in 45 minutes just fine. And if we were really pressed for time, you could probably get your point across in 15.
Well, I mean, I will agree with that. And as far as the media not, you know, grasping these things, that isn't true just in Iraq. I mean, most media people, unfortunately, are not specialists. And so they get an assignment. I once did a story about the National Rifle Association, and it turns out I had been writing about that organization for a while, and I went down to their convention. I think it was when they were in Dallas, Texas, and I found that the reporters who'd been, you know, told to go cover the National Rifle Association didn't know anything about it at all. And there they're flying into Dallas to go to their annual convention, and they didn't know who the board of directors was, and they didn't know who the staff and the political leaders were. And you know, maybe they knew something about, oh, there's this guy Wayne LaPierre, who I guess is important. And so they were all coming to me saying, "Can you explain, like, what's happening here and who are these people?" And I was not exactly an expert, but I'd spent a few months off and on writing about it. And so these were people parachuting in. And that happens time and time again with the media, where, you know, people go and they listen to speeches and they get the press release and they interview a couple of experts who they've Googled or something, and then that's their story. And it's not, you know, the media doesn't come at this, unfortunately, with a great, you know, wealth of stored up expertise.
Mm-hmm. All right, let me try to get back to this tangent here real quick that I wanted to follow up on from the Hezbollah story and the Associated Press today.
Yep.
Apparently, this general is claiming that was it Brigadier General Kevin Bergner, a U.S. military spokesman, claimed that the Iranian Quds Force was behind the January attack in Karbala, the kidnapping and execution of those American soldiers. And it was suspected at the time by some that it was Iran behind it, that because Bush was ratcheting up the pressure and making threats on TV, sending more ships to the Persian Gulf, that the Iranians had done this as an example of how easily they can get to our guys in Iraq, dress, you know, even driving our Suburbans wearing our uniforms,
right,
kidnap our guys and murder them. Do you know anything about that? Can you confirm that or deny it or anything?
I remember the incident, of course, very well. And in terms of being able to know whether Iran was behind it or not, I just don't have, you know, information that would, you know, tell me either way. But I guess I'm skeptical, only because, you know, now they're coming to this late and saying, oh yeah, we've looked into this and we've decided that Iran is responsible. I don't know.
Yeah, it sounds like they want to try to use it as an extra piece for their case, as a, you know, a casus belli, an excuse for war. Where to me, I mean, if I got to spin it, I'll spin it the way I just did. You know, this was a warning, and this is to me a big clue why we ought to not get into a war with Iran.
Yeah, I mean, look, Iran is by far now the biggest power in Iraq. We've come pretty close to just, you know, handing Iran control of this country, and putting their people in power. And it isn't that they have to then, you know, fight us you know, military terms. They can just afford to, you know, sit back and let the things develop as they would otherwise develop, and it'll end up, you know, falling into their hands. And so I think if we're going to get out of Iraq, unfortunately, it's going to start with us going to the Iranians, but also other Iraqi neighbors, and, you know, working out some sort of regional arrangement, and that means giving Iran something. It means making a deal with Iran where they're willing to, you know, give up some influence in Iraq and rein in some of these Shia forces that are out of our control. And
we're going to do that instead of just turning it over to the nationalists who are waiting in the wings right now.
Well, I mean, we can't, you know, destroy these pro-Iranian forces. They're powerful. There's got to be a compromise. But what I'm saying is that you can take into account the Iraqi nationalists. You can take into account the Shia pro-Iran parties. You can take into account what Iran's interests are and Saudi Arabia's and Turkey's and everybody else's, and try to come up with something that makes everybody happy enough that the war stops. And I think that's doable. I think you can achieve that if it's carried out under United Nations auspices and internationalizing the crisis and everything else. But it's not something that we can solve ourselves as the United States, and it's certainly not something that we can solve militarily.
So you think we need to get the United Nations in on it? In what way?
Well, I mean, at least in 100 ways, in coming up with perhaps peacekeeping forces, but more importantly, getting the United Nations in to negotiate this national compact that we seem unable to negotiate, and providing a forum for all of Iraq's neighbors to then, you know, exert a certain influence over their proxies inside Iraq. And so if we can work, you know, if we can work through the United Nations, then perhaps the United Nations could come up with an internal forum for a national reconciliation and an external one involving all of Iraq's neighbors. I'm not saying this is easily done, but it's the only way of, you know, preventing this war from spiraling out of control. I mean, it could fail now that things have gotten so bad. There's no more guarantees that any of this is going to work because we've made such a mess of it.
Well, everybody, you see why when I want to know, I turn to Robert Dreyfus to explain. He's a freelance investigative reporter, writes for Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, The Nation magazine. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. His latest one in The Nation is called Saving Iraq. And you can find all he writes and his blog and everything at robertdreyfus.com. Thanks very much for your time today, sir. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Scott.
Listen to Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm the host of the show. It's Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. And, I'm Scott Horton. I'm an assistant editor at antiwar.com, and I do the Anti-War Radio thing for him, too. You'll be able to find that great interview of Robert Dreyfus in its entirety later on this afternoon, hopefully. Well, actually, it won't be till tonight, because I've got some stuff to do this afternoon. But, antiwar.com. We'll have the archive there. My blog, thestressblog.com. Stop by. Write some crazy funny thing in the comment section like so many people do. That's thestressblog.com. Buy my stickers. Help keep my electricity on. LibertyStickers.com, the Scott Horton section there. And the phone number here, 646-6446, 646-6446. If you're listening online from out of town, you got to put the area code in front of it, 512 for Austin, Texas. 512-646-6446. So, yeah, it's Monday, July 2nd, 2007. This is Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and I wanted to point to LouRockwell.com today. Two great articles about the fascism of Franklin Roosevelt, the worst president in American history, worse than George Bush by far, and my least favorite, really, person in all of American history, not just president, the destroyer of all things good, the ruiner of what was once okay, Franklin Roosevelt. Well, there's a letter from Bob Higgs to an author who wrote about the failure of the New Deal, where Bob Higgs says, yeah, well, the World War II wasn't any better, pal. Yeah, what you ought to do is read Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace by Harry Elmer Barnes, edited by Harry Elmer Barnes. And read that and you will know. Real short and sweet. He doesn't really get into any of the arguments in the book. He just says, read this and get back to me. That's Bob Higgs over there at the Independent Institute. And then Ralph Rako, Fascism Comes to America, the Early Years. And I just wanted to read the first few paragraphs of this one for you. The figure Franklin Roosevelt looms ever more imposing in the minds of Americans. In the two centuries or so of our history, it has happened that a few of our leaders, a very few, became symbols of some powerful idea, one that left a permanent imprint on the life of our country. Thomas Jefferson is one such symbol. With Jefferson, it is the idea of a free, self-governing people, dedicated to the enjoyment of their God-given natural rights in their work, their communities, and their families. Abraham Lincoln symbolized a rather different idea of America as a great centralized nation-state, supposedly dedicated to individual freedom, but founded on the unquestioned authority and power of the national government in Washington. And now Franklin Roosevelt, too, has come to represent a certain conception of America, one that is worlds apart from Jefferson's vision and different from anything that even Lincoln could have imagined. Roosevelt stands for the national government as we know it today, a vast, unfathomable bureaucratic apparatus that recognizes no limits whatsoever to its power, either at home or abroad. Internationally, it gives every evidence of intending to run the whole world, of extending its hegemony, now that the Soviet Union is no more, to every corner of the globe. Domestically, it undertakes, through an annual budget of close to $2 trillion, wow, this must be an old article because, of course, it's over $3 trillion now. This article must be at least a year or two old, because that's about how long it's taken for the budget to increase by $1 trillion. To assuage every real or invented social ill, and thus enters into every aspect of the people's lives. In particular, it is engaged in what even a couple of decades ago would have seemed fantastic, a campaign to annihilate freedom of association, subjecting the American people to a program of radical social engineering in order to transform their voluntarily held traditional beliefs and values in a way of life. More than anyone else, Franklin Roosevelt is responsible for creating the Leviathan state that confronts us today. And, you know, there's a lot more. And in fact, he gets in there to how all the neocons nowadays, they love FDR. They love him, which is just a little bit more evidence that there's really nothing conservative about those guys, unless, of course, well, but see, that's the thing. In their ignorance, there's nothing conservative about them. If they were to really be smart, then they would understand that Roosevelt was, in fact, himself a conservative, not a socialist, but a fascist, really. The kind of fascist who is willing to expand the authority of the state to no limit in order to achieve his conservative ends, preserving the wealth, power, status, privilege of the people who are already rich, which is basically the definition of conservatism, not just to protect their property from crime, but to protect them from competition from abroad, from their from their neighbors, from the weather, from anything. Yeah, so if you've been brought up your whole life brainwashed to believe that somehow Franklin Delano Roosevelt is some American hero, why not take a look at LouRockwell.com today for another point of view? They got two articles up there on the topic. He was the American fascist. And in fact, Franklin Roosevelt was probably the greatest traitor of all time. You know, Benedict Arnold is synonymous with treason. But really, it should be Franklin Roosevelt that's synonymous with treason. It's Franklin Roosevelt who deliberately set about a program to provoke the Japanese into firing the first shots, and then withheld the information that the Navy was on its way, that the Japanese Navy was on its way to Pearl Harbor. Cut the commanders, Admiral Kimmel and General Short in Hawaii, out of the loop, while people beneath them had the intelligence they did not, and set them up to be bombed. Got 3,500 Americans killed. Bunch of 19-year-old kids blown apart and drowned before they got to live their lives, so that FDR could trick the American people, who at that point were 88% opposed to entering World War II, into doing so, so that he could go and save Joseph Stalin and the Soviet Union before it was too late. That's treason. Big time. And there's a million footnotes about it. Infamy by John Toland is the most famous. But of course, there's also, and really more to the point, I don't know what proof you could possibly need beyond that offered by Robert B. Stinnett in his book, Day of Deceit, The Truth About FDR and Pearl Harbor. And if you go to my blog, thestressblog.com, and look for his name in the margin there, or go to scotthortonshow.com and look for the archives, you can find two previous interviews that I've done with Robert B. Stinnett, and he thinks it was a good thing. He says, hey, look, FDR had to set up those boys to die at Pearl Harbor so we could go defeat the Nazis, because the Nazis wouldn't attack us. And if we didn't stop them, they would have overthrown us, and we'd all be speaking German right now. And I said, well, what do you mean? Either they were going to take us over, or we couldn't get them to attack us. We had to get the Japanese to do it. Which is it? I'm confused. So he justifies it, Robert B. Stinnett, he justifies it. Says FDR did the right thing by committing the greatest act of treason in all of human history. I can't think of one worse. Can you guys think of a worse act of treason than allowing the attack at Pearl Harbor to happen? Deliberately turning a blind eye to that attack? Boy, I bet I got all the 9/11 kooks in a tizzy now. Yeah, FDR, man. What a hell of a thing. I guess, just, you know, basic common sense, if he's at the top of the list of favorite presidents of all the historians in America who all get their wonderful foundation grants to write their wonderful history textbooks, that ought to be a clue that actually he's the worst. And, you know, frankly, I really resent the idea that Franklin Roosevelt is somehow the founder of this country. That World War II, rather than the American Revolution, is the good war. It's not true. And unlike George Washington, who said, okay, battle's won, here's your sword, I resign my commission, I'm going home to be the tyrant of my own little piece of private property in Virginia, Franklin Roosevelt ran for four terms. He wanted to put, if he had lived, he wanted to put UN headquarters at his house, near, next door to his house in Hyde Park. He wanted a world government of America, Britain, China, and Russia combined together to divvy up the rest of the world. He was a sick little wannabe Napoleon. The great dictator, Franklin Roosevelt, who now has replaced George Washington as the founder of the United States, as our... Not the founder, but you know what I'm saying. He's replaced George Washington in our pantheon. And what a disaster that is. And don't tell me that World War II was fought to save the Jews in the concentration camps, because it wasn't. In fact, And I've been going back and forth in the email with a friend of mine about this. They were on the do not bomb no matter what list. They weren't just on the don't target the death camps, don't target the railways to the death camps. They were on the, even if you're on your way back and you have extra bombs, don't hit these as secondary targets. Basically the same lists that the General Motors, Ford, and other American corporate factories were on. But anyway, so yeah, I'm sorry. Once I get to going on Franklin Roosevelt, I could spend the whole show, but I won't do that to you. Yeah, it looks like a lot of people listening. That's good. This is Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas. I started the show, if you missed it, I started the show talking about this article that we're running on antiwar.com today by Arash Nowruzi, his follow-up to the rumor of the century, explaining in great detail that no, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad never did say that Iran was going to wipe Israel off the map. It was a bad translation, and it's been deliberately pushed, even though the fact that it's a bad translation has been known all along. This guy, Arash Nowruzi, does a really good job of explaining not just what really happened, but also the mass media's culpability in continuing to put out the lie. And so, you know, I don't know if you guys all just have a little piece of paper that you keep handy that's lies that I heard Scott Horton and the boys on Anti-War Radio debunk about Iran. You can just add wipe Israel off the map right there under nuclear weapons program, explosively foreign penetrators in Iraq, they back Sadr, not our allies in Iraq. What are the lies? What am I missing? I'm missing some of the lies about Iran. Somebody help me out, man. I'm having a short-term memory lapse here. Let's see. There was the non-existent nuclear weapons program and all those lies. And then there's Iran's responsible for all the deaths of Americans in Iraq. That's a lie. And then there's threatened to wipe Israel off the map. That's a damn lie. Never happened there. And then, but there's one I'm missing. I don't know. Maybe if you have a list of lies about Iran that Scott Horton's debunked, maybe you can help remind me. There's four or five of them, really. I don't know. Okay. Anyway, so Dick Lugar has told Bob Schaefer, I'm sorry, Dick Lugar, a powerful Republican member of the Imperial Senate, has told Bob Schaefer on Face the Nation that, well, just like Robert Dreyfus just said, the Iraqi government can't do what we say it's got to do, and the surge isn't going to help it. And so it's time to start withdrawing troops out of there now. Dick Lugar is no Ron Paul by a long shot, as Justin Raimondo points out in his article on antiwar.com today. Lugar's interest is in preserving Republican votes only. Innocent lives in Iraq mean nothing to him. The lives of American soldiers in Iraq mean nothing to him whatsoever, obviously. But he's worried that those lives might mean something to us, and that the Republicans might really lose a lot of power in 2008 if something isn't done quickly. So he's saying, nope, screw September. I don't want to wait till a progress report. I'm telling you now, it's not working out. He's been asked whether he's willing to do anything about his new public stance. And of course, he answered, hell no, he's not. So for what good that's done any of us, I'm not sure. I guess the optimistic spin is that if Dick Lugar can come out and denounce the war, then so can John Warner. And actually, John Warner basically supported what Lugar said. Imperial Senator Voinovich from Ohio also has joined in there. So we'll see whether this makes it easier for other Republican members of the Imperial Senate to begin withdrawing their support from the Bush White House and their murderous policy of Iraqi occupation. That continues. And man, you know, American soldiers are dying over there. And this is the kind of thing that you know, with all the coverage of the war before the war, you'd have thought they'd cover the war since the war. Good friend of mine on the phone pointed out to me that when the news broke about the supposed car bomb that, you know, could have caught fire in Great Britain, that in the time that they spent covering, the cable news channels spent covering the war, there were 37. See, I'm ahead of myself and lost and maybe behind. What I mean to say is, in the time that the screaming cable news ladies spent hysterically screaming about how vigilant we all have to be because there was some firebomb in a car in Great Britain, there were 37 bombings in Iraq. Just in that first day, in that first little period of 5 or 6 or 8 hours of TV cable news, which 37 bombs went off in Iraq. And I read one of these stories was five guys on patrol, on foot patrol, set off a landmine or somebody triggered it or what have you, blew these five guys apart. But that doesn't get so much as a mention on cable news because I'm just supposed to be scared to death that there were some propane tanks and gasoline in a car and it didn't light. 3,000 miles away from my house. I love watching the American reporters on the street in England. Oh my God! Oh my God! Are you scared? How are you going to change your life from now on because of this? And the English people look at the American reporters and say, I'm not. What are you talking about? I don't know. Bob Dreyfus says that's how they make their money. That's what Americans love to watch on TV is Paris Hilton and hysteria about car bombs that don't go off. I don't know. Maybe it's true. Remember, though, that poll last week that had almost half the American people believing still that Saddam Hussein did 9/11 also said that 77% of the American people didn't know and didn't care who won American Idol. So maybe we're not all as dumb as TV keeps telling us we are. Maybe they are trying to get us to care about Paris Hilton instead of what's going on the ground in Iraq. But then again, you know, supply and demand. I tell you what, if I was Joe Scarborough, I'd kill myself before I did one more show about who's ahead on American Idol. I'd kill myself live on TV. Hi, this is Joe Scarborough. Welcome to Scarborough Country. Coming up next, a segment about American Idol. But first, I'm going to put this gun in my mouth and end it all live for you here on MSNBC. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. Just wanted to touch bases with you. There were a couple of Iran myths that you forgot to mention.
Oh, okay.
One was that Iran is harboring Al-Qaeda.
Oh, yeah. How could I have forgotten that? What a load of crap that is, huh?
Of course it is, but most people don't. They're brown people, so I guess most people in America aren't going to know. And there are a couple others. One, there's Al-Qaeda. There's Iran is backing the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Oh, man. I did mention that in the first hour, though.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, those were some of the other Iran myths that are currently going around. So, yeah.
Okay, wait. So hang on. Let me make sure and write this down. Okay, so we got the non-existent nuclear program.
Yeah.
And then we have they're responsible for all the terrible bombs in Iraq that are killing our guys. They're backing the Sunni insurgency. That makes a lot of sense. And then,
yeah.
As you point out, there's the lie that they're backing the Taliban in
mm-hmm.
Afghanistan and harboring Al-Qaeda members in their country.
Well, there is some truth. They're harboring them in their jails, but...
right. And now, let's be specific about that case for a little bit since you brought it up. I really like this story. And again, Gareth Porter, who I bring on to the show all the time for you guys here, has done an incredible amount of reporting on this in the American Prospect and for IPS News and antiwar.com. And, you know, the Washington Post has even covered it as well. Iran tried to turn over all of their arrested al-Qaeda guys to America. They said, hey, we arrested a bunch of al-Qaeda guys. You want them? Well, all you have to do is give us some Mujahideen al-Khalq members. And the Mujahideen al-Khalq, of course, is that kind of Heaven's Gate communist cult that used to, terrorist group that used to belong to Saddam Hussein for murdering Iranians with, and now belongs to America for murdering Iranians with. And the Iranians said, here, just give us five members of the Mujahideen al-Khalq, and we'll give you five members of al-Qaeda. And the neocons and the office of the vice president said, hell no. And in fact told the Swiss ambassador to tell them to go and screw themselves and that he ought to while he's at it.
Yeah.
So there's Iran back in al-Qaeda.
That's about it. And the other one was obviously that Ahmadinejad wants to create a second Holocaust.
Oh, right, right. The wipe off the map. See, there's so many lies, it's hard for me to keep them all straight here. Appreciate it very much.
Sure, you're welcome, Scott.
Thanks a lot for calling.
Take care.
Anybody else wants to call in, it's 646-6446, 646-6446. I have trouble talking on the radio and writing at the same time, apparently, but yeah, there's my list. If anybody else has any more to add to the list there, please feel free to. It's, so far we have the non-existent nuclear weapons program. We have Iran responsible for the bombs killing Americans in Iraq, backing the Taliban in Afghanistan, harboring al-Qaeda, terrorists against the United States, and threatening to use their non-existent nuclear weapons to wipe Israel, which has over 400 of them, off the map. So, there you go. That's a good five lies so far. And we'll see if they can come up with any better ones. I think the chances of war with Iran are getting less and less by the day rather than more and more. But, of course, we're only a border incident away. We're only a cruise missile strike away. We're only staged provocation, whether by the Iranians, by the Americans, or, again, as Gareth Porter, the great reporter, a couple of weeks ago on this show discussed the possibility that al-Qaeda would stage an attack on Americans and try to make it look like Iran, or at least make it plausible enough that Dick Cheney could blame it on Iran, because that's what bin Laden wants, is for America to go to war with Iran. The Ayatollahs, those dogs, the Ayatollahs, they're next on bin Laden's list. And, you know, from when they killed Zarqawi, they said, hey, look, we found, oh, that's a funny thing. Hey, reporter guy, come over here and take a look at this. It says here in this here paperwork that, the al-Qaeda is trying to get us to start a war with Iran. I guess that would make it okay that we've turned Iraq over to them, right? As long as we get a regime change there, too. And then I guess, you know what, we'll install the Azerbaijani faction, and then we'll just have to do a regime change in Azerbaijan. And then Uzbekistan, and then Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan again, and then, hell, why not do a regime change in Russia? Right? It's not like they have any ability to fight back, do they? Not that I ever heard of. All right, 646-6446, 646-6446, if anybody else wants to call on the show. It's Intel War Radio on Chaos Radio 95.9 in Austin, Texas.
Against the wall, they're up there clutching their guns, man, and it makes you feel real small. So, guys, face the moon. Look at glass when it is with the hand just on your hand. You run around, spray paint graffiti on everybody's wall. You think that's bitchin', man? That ain't nothing at all. So you can just miss.
right, then. This is Anti-War Radio again. I'm Scott, and it's Chaos Radio, 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. Frank Rich at the New York Times wrote an op-ed that we're running a link to today in the Viewpoint section at antiwar.com, and it's about this fight that's been going on last week. I'm sure you all heard about it. Jay Leno and all them were talking about it, I guess. The vice president was claiming that he's not a member of the executive branch, so these classification rules don't apply to him. Well, don't you know, he's the president of the Senate. Has a tie-breaking vote. And since he has a legislative function, that means he's not part of the executive branch, even though all of his job description is in Article 2 of the Constitution. And as some guy on TV, I think, pointed out, the president has a legislative function, too. He can veto bills. Does that mean he's not the executive branch? But this has been really the entire theory of the Bush presidency, that the vice president's office is outside of reach of the law, that there is impunity there in the office of the vice president, and that they can get away with whatever they want. So having Cheney as Bush's number two guy is the very best setup that they could hope for. But so basically, here's what Frank Rich says in this article. He says, look, during this fight, people are kind of ignoring the paperwork and the law that was created that the fight is about. And that is this Office of Classification. I don't know what it's called. I forget what it's called. There's something about, you know, the official rules and regulations for how classified information is to be treated. And what's interesting that he notes that the orders that Bush signed that gave Dick Cheney the power to classify and declassify things was granted to him right at the time that the story of the Niger uranium forgeries was breaking out. And we all know that the vice president's office was the center of the conspiracy to out the CIA agent Valerie Plame in an attempt, apparently, at least the outward motive, to ruin her husband, Ambassador Joe Wilson, who had written an article for the New York Times called What I Did Not Find in Africa, about the bogus nature of the claims that Saddam Hussein had tried to buy completely, you know, unrefined yellow cake uranium, when he had uranium is already more refined right there in his country under UN lock and key, of course. But if he wanted to make a nuclear bomb, he had better uranium right there in his country. Surely he wasn't going to buy 500,000 tons of it or whatever the hell it was, and the lie and the forged documents that, well, we've all suspected all along, haven't we, that the neocons and the Cheney cabal were behind the Niger forgeries. Ray McGovern recently said, oh, in fact, you know what? I interviewed Ray McGovern last week and I didn't ask him about this. Oh, geez. But Ray McGovern said he's pretty certain that those forgeries originated in America with the vice president and his men before they made their way to Italy and back again through the stovepipe to lie us into war. But anyway, I'm off the point. The point is, according to the way Frank Rich puts the story together, it looks like George Bush was himself personally involved in the conspiracy to out Valerie Plame and destroy Joe Wilson, an act that his own father, the former president, termed treason, which it's really not, but still. I just think that's interesting, and it's a great excuse, again, really, isn't it, to bring up the Niger uranium forgeries? Remember, this is how they got Congress to vote for this thing. Well, they probably would have anyway, but this was the big lie that Iraq... It's so funny now to think about it, isn't it? That somehow Saddam Hussein had some sophisticated nuclear program, centrifuges spinning around, enriching uranium to bomb grade. Give me a break. They had nada. But that was the big lie. Aluminum tubes and Niger forgeries. And aluminum tubes, of course, were for rockets, not for centrifuges. And the aluminum tubes could not even be modified to be used as decent centrifuges. And, of course, the Niger uranium sale claims were based completely on forgeries. Forgeries. That's how they got us into this war, by forging documents. Although anyone who let themselves be dumb enough to believe that Iraq had some advanced nuclear weapons program or one at all in the run-up to war is just a fool, and you have no one to blame but yourselves. I mean, they told me those same lies, and I didn't believe them. So, you know, what does that tell you? Saddam Hussein, yeah, he's going to make a nuke, and we can't wait for the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. They said that with straight faces on TV. Oh, yeah, don't you know Iraq might nuke us if we don't go invade them first. It's really too bad that. Give me a break. It's already taken. That's the John Stossel thing. And then my version, really, I can say on Chaos Radio, but be no good for long-term tagline, you know? All right, moving on here to something. Oh, yeah. This is funny. Did you guys see this one? It's in, from antiwar.com today. The headline in the top section there. A president besieged and isolated, yet at ease. And this is from the Washington Post. Just to give you a clue about where our president's at. I read this article last night. It inspired a new bumper sticker. Bush, grasping for answers and fixated on Iraq, remains resolute. At the nadir of his presidency, George W. Bush is looking for answers. One at a time or in small groups, he summons leading authors, historians, philosophers, and theologians to the White House to join him in the search. I'm sorry. I just get a big kick out of that. Seeing how ridiculous and stupid George Bush is. Yeah. Over sodas and sparkling water, he asks his questions. What is the nature of good and evil in the post-September 11th world? What lessons does history have for a president facing the turmoil I'm facing? How will history judge what I've done? Why does the rest of the world seem to hate America? Or is it just me they hate? Yeah, it's both, George. But especially you. These are the questions of a president who has endured the most drastic political collapse in a generation. Not generally known for his intellectual curiosity, Bush is seeking out those who are engaging in a philosophical exploration of the currents of history that have swept up his administration. Wow, this is some really crappy writing here, Mr. Baker. For all the setbacks, he remains unflinching. Rarely expressing doubt in his direction, yet trying to understand how he got off course. Yeah, maybe it was launching that aggressive war. These sessions, usually held in the Oval Office or the elegant living areas of the Executive Mansion, are never listed on the president's public schedule and remain largely unknown even to many on his staff. To some of those invited to talk, Bush seems alone, isolated by events beyond his control, with trusted advisors taking their leave and erstwhile friends turning on him. You think about prime ministers and presidents being surrounded by cabinet officials and aides and so forth, said Alistair Horn, a British historian who met with Bush recently. But at the end of the day, they're alone. They're lonely. And that's what occurred to me as I was at the White House. It must be quite difficult for him to get out and about. I feel so sorry for poor George W. Bush. Friends worry about that as well. Burdened by an unrelenting war, challenged by an opposition Congress, defeated just last week on immigration, his last major domestic priority, Bush remains largely locked inside the fortress of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue in the seventh year of a presidency turned sour. He's still turned sour. God, this is such a crap. You know, I just freaking sorry, y'all, for reading this, but it's the... It's the context, man. The quality, the information, the important news buried within this horribly overwritten Washington Post article. He still travels, making speeches to friendly audiences and attending summit meetings, such as this weekend's Kennebunkport talks with President Vladimir Putin of Russia. But he rarely goes out to dinner, and he no longer plays golf except occasionally chipping at Camp David, where he can find refuge. I don't know how he copes with it, said Donald Burnham Ensenat, a friend for 43 years who just stepped down as State Department protocol officer. Representative K. Michael Conway, Republican of Texas, another longtime friend who once worked for Bush, says he looks worn down. Quote, it's a marked difference in his physical appearance. It's an incredibly heavy load. When you ask men and women to take risks, to send them into war knowing they might not come home, that's got to be an incredible burden to have on your shoulders. Bush is fixated on Iraq, according to friends and advisors. One former aide went to see him recently to discuss various matters, only to find Bush turning the conversation back to Iraq again and again. He recognizes that his presidency hinges on whether Iraq can be turned around in 18 months. Nothing matters except the war, said one person close to Bush. That's all that matters. The whole thing rides on that. And yet, you know, this is really the thing here. I think Bob Dreyfus is right. Not just the reporters, but, you know, the people in D.C. too. They really have no idea that this war has been lost since 2003. They really don't know that, do they? After all this time, everything is riding on the Iraq war being a success. What? In July of 2007, there's a question as to whether Iraq is going to work out okay or not. After 600 and something or more thousand dead civilians. Wow. Yeah, boy. The unreality of living in D.C., I guess. I sit and read the news from Austin, Texas, and I can tell you now, I've known since, well, at least this time, 2003, probably June 2003. Oh, man, this is over. I was surprised to see how welcomed the American soldiers were. You know, which wasn't all that much, but it was something. But the window of opportunity was slammed shut by the end of the summer. By the beginning of the summer of 2003. They fired the whole government to start over. Put stupid Paul Bremer in charge. Delayed the elections until after Bush could get reelected. So the American people wouldn't see that all he had done was set up the Iranians to take over the country. And this whole thing has been an absolute disaster from beginning to end, and the killing goes on there. And there's a question somehow of Bush's legacy and whether Iraq is going to work out as a success. It's too late to be a success. There are too many dead bodies already for this to be a success. Even if everything worked out the way Bob Dreyfus tried to explain that it could, with different nationalist factions getting together and making deals and working with the neighboring states, etc., etc. You still already killed hundreds of thousands of people, man. And yet Bush does not come across like a man lamenting his plight, reads the Post. In public and in private, according to intimates, he exhibits an inexorable upbeat energy that defies the political storms. Even when he convenes philosophical discussions with scholars, he avoids second-guessing his actions. He still acts as if he was the master of the universe. even if the rest of Washington no longer sees him that way. You don't get any feeling of somebody crouching down in a bunker, said Irwin M. Stelzer, a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute who was part of one group of scholars who met with Bush. This is either extraordinary self-confidence or out of touch with reality. I can't tell you which. I think it's both. I think for Bush to have confidence in himself is to be out of touch with reality. I mean, we're talking about the worst president since Bill Clinton, since Richard Nixon, since Harry Truman, since Franklin Roosevelt. Oh, geez, and then they go through. I just wanted to read this one more paragraph real quick just because it has a list of some more of his failures in it. The poll reflects the events of Bush's second term, an unyielding sequence of bad news. Social Security, Hurricane Katrina, Harriet Myers, Dubai Ports World, Cheney's hunting accident. Shut up about that. Cheney shoots one guy in the face. It gets all the news. He shoots 600,000 in the face, and nobody even cares. Jack Abramoff, Tom DeLay, Mark Foley, the midterm elections, Scooter Libby, Alberto Gonzalez, Paul Wolfowitz, immigration, and overshadowing it all, the Iraq War, now longer than the U.S. fight in World War II. And I love this. This is all about, here it is. Here's the quote. This is the same thing Seymour Hersh has been telling us, isn't it? About Iran, about Bush's intention to bomb Iran. Bush has virtually given up on winning converts while in office and instead is counting on vindication after he is dead. He almost has a sense of fatalism, said Representative Peter T. King, Republican in New York, who recently spent a day traveling with Bush. All he can do is his best, and 100 years from now, people will decide if he was right or wrong. It doesn't seem to be a false macho pride in living in your own world. I find him to be amazingly calm. So that was obviously the inspiration for my new bumper sticker. 100 years from now, we'll all still hate you. God, can you imagine if that was the best you could do to keep from putting a pistol in your mouth and blowing your head off, that 100 years from now, they'll think back about me and maybe enough of the details will have been covered over by then. Well, yes, 100 years from now, they'll say George Bush started the world war that got all Muslims on Earth killed in the great nuclear holocaust of Hillary Clinton's, you know, Hillary Clinton started in 09. And thank goodness for that. That probably is what they'll be saying 100 years from now. Okay, so I'm sorry. Too much time. The terrorism plots in England. A couple of car bombs that were basically worthless. We ran the article. The Stratfor guys did the I wouldn't say quite lengthy, but yeah. Pretty in-depth article explaining about the bombs in those cars and how the worst they could have done was set fire if they had worked. Yesterday, was it yesterday or day before yesterday? Guy set himself on fire and crashed his truck into the wall at an airport. Burned himself. Nobody else killed. Brits everywhere turned to each other and went, eh, so what? Went back to work or back to the pub. And yet you turn it to TV news in America, and it's just nothing but the shrieking, hysterical woman club all day long. They've removed all the male news anchors, and it's nothing but shrieking, hysterical women talking about how unfortunate it is and how we're really going to have to work on the problem. That the government in America cannot scan every car in America for car bombs all day, every day. Isn't it a shame? What are we going to do? I mean, it's just not feasible. for the government to scan every car in America. What are we gonna do? We'll just have to be vigilant. Everybody be vigilant. Are you being vigilant? Hey. Feet off that desk. Hand out from under that chin. We need you to be vigilant. Vigilance from you. That'll stop those Islamo-fascists. And I think if there's one real lesson to be learned from this horrifying terroristic threat in England, it's that there's no longer a definition for the term Al-Qaeda. It no longer means anything. Or maybe it means everything, and that's the same thing. It might as well mean nothing. Al-Qaeda. Yeah, some guy fucking put some propane tanks in the backseat of a car and poured some gasoline around and woulda, coulda, shoulda blew up but didn't. Al-Qaeda. Yeah, show me some evidence. Show me where this guy knows I'm an Al-Zawahiri. Show me where this guy got trained by Al-Qaeda in Iraq before he came to Great Britain. Or stop lying. But, you know, if you're going to keep making those assertions, it seems like offering some evidence that Al-Qaeda is behind this dastardly plot. You know, seems like some evidence would be in order. If that's what you're going to keep calling it. But seriously, I think if this is what Al-Qaeda is down to, we're going to be all right. Here, I thought the Islamo-fascists were about to take over the entire Western Hemisphere. But apparently there's no threat at all from these people. If the best that they can do is try to set a car on fire and fail to do so. I love Stratford. Those guys said, well, you know, if this bomb had worked, it might have caught the car on fire. But this is what I've been trying to tell you. That 9/11 was their last gasp. It was their Hail Mary attempt. It was, look, our Mujahideen warriors are all going home. Everybody's getting old. The Afghan war was a long time ago. How are we ever going to be the leaders of the revolutionary movement in this place? We gotta get something going on. Oh, sweet. We got some young grad students, some pissed off young grad students, living in Germany who've come to volunteer their services. Great. Send them to America and knock those towers down. See if you can trick America into coming over here to fight us. It's the last chance we have, guys. Ready, break. That was their Hail Mary attempt. That was their last gasp. There's only a couple hundred Mujahideen warriors left in Bin Laden's group. We got to do something before it all goes away. So they did 9/11. And, of course, we overreacted in exactly the way, well, beyond, far beyond their wildest dreams, really, and creating new terrorists. And, you know, I think it's likely that there will be a continued terrorist threat to Europe and perhaps to America as a result of this war. Lord knows there's a lot of young Arabs who have now hours and hours and hours of practice, semester hours, you could even call them, of practice shooting at Americans, making bombs out of household items, blowing people up with them. And it's the kind of thing that I have been saying for years throughout this whole war, and it's now the kind of thing that's in the paper all the time. It's in the headlines all the time. Every think tank, every intelligence agency, every group of military officers, anyone in this world who has asked the question has come up with the same answer as me. The war in Iraq has been good for Al-Qaeda and bad for America. It has created a brand new training ground for them. It's like Gladiator Academy. I one time saw a critic of the drug war and a critic of the American prison system said, what, you going to take this guy who got busted with some drugs in his pocket and now you going to send him to Gladiator Academy where he's got to learn to be a ruthless killer just to protect, just to stay alive in there? Yeah, good idea. Well, that's the same kind of back-ass resolution that we're throwing down in Iraq. Let's turn the whole thing into a big Gladiator Academy. So, yeah, I think there will be a threat of actual terrorists. I think the likelihood of them being able to pull off September 11th-sized attacks in America anymore are greatly reduced. But people want to say, oh, there's been no attacks in America since September 11th. It must be because Bush is doing a good job. No. All quantifiable evidence points to the fact that he has made matters worse. The fact is, matters weren't that bad in the first place. September 11th was their last gasp, their Hail Mary pass. You wonder why people haven't taken AKs and gone and shot up malls and car dealerships and, hell, everybody's standing in line at the airport on the street side of the metal detector, for that matter. You wonder why that hasn't happened. It's because there's no Al-Qaeda here. There's nobody to do it. You look at all the terrorism busts. It's all been the dumbest kid at the Islamic bookstore that they entrapped into saying something stupid. There are no terrorists here. That's why there's been no terrorist attacks. And yeah, you know, checking who's getting off a plane from the Middle East can help with that. But it's not that our government has thwarted a thing. They haven't. So you're talking about a phony war. You're talking about a war on a terrorist group that at the time of the September 11th attack had maybe a couple of thousand members, probably more like a couple of hundred. And now, really, we've turned it into a movement. Michael Scheuer says, we are completing the radicalization of the Islamic world, something that Osama bin Laden had been trying to do with quite partial success up until the time that we won overshot in Afghanistan, overthrowing the government and mass murdering civilians there up until this day, and also going on into the invasion of Iraq. Now the new proxy war in Somalia and the rest of that. So there's your war on terrorism. There's your president's legacy. How will they see me in 100 years? They will see you as a mass butcherer of women, children, old men. They'll see you as the man who destroyed the writ of habeas corpus that has protected people under jurisdiction of Anglo-American law since the year 1215 AD, when King John signed the Magna Carta at sword point. They will see him as a torturer, a mass murderer, a wager of aggressive war, and the man who made bin Laden a hero. The man who made our terrorism problem worse. The man who signed the first $3 trillion budget. The man who tried to make Harriet Myers an associate justice on the United States Supreme Court. The man who is the worst president since Clinton. Since Nixon. Since Johnson. Since Truman. Since Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the American fascist. That's the legacy of George W. Bush. It'll never be anything but that. All right, that's it for me. I'll be back tomorrow. Hopefully, I'm going to try to get a hold of Chris Floyd and see if he can give us an update on the situation in America's proxy war in Africa. I bet I can get that done. Tune in tomorrow, 11:01 Texas time for Anti-War Radio on Radio Chaos 95.9. In Austin, Texas. Step into a world where there's no one there. Island of Austin! But the very best no MC can tell.
mission. If a dope lyrical flow is a must, you got to go with the name you can quickly drop. I'm not saying I'm number one. I'm sorry, I lied. I'm number one, two, three, four, and five. Stop wasting your money on marketing schemes and pretty packages pushing dreams to the fiends.